Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Zingari. We'll do a little skiing later, maybe even my favorite, extreme sledding, and we'll learn about opportunities for adoption in the state of Vermont. We'll finish the morning with open phones, talking about coincidences that have happened to you. But first, let's discuss a subject that has been talked about a lot in this state for a number of years, the effort to bring high-speed internet to everyone in the state. As we've learned through the years, this is not easy for a number of reasons, and we'll discuss some of those this morning. But with frustration and struggle comes ideas that become answers and reality. Several years ago, I remember speaking to a person who said this could be accomplished, but done by communities pulling together regionally, forming something called a Communications Union District, or CUD. That person is with me now as the chair of CV Fiber, Jeremy Hansen. And Jeremy, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Listeners, to ask Jeremy about CV Fiber and CUDs, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jeremy, start us off. What is a Communications Utility District, or CUD?
A Communications Union District
Yep. Sorry.
No, it's all good. It's almost like a school district. You know, we have school districts that encompass multiple towns, or a sewer district, water district that might encompass more than one town. So we are a collection right now of 21 towns and cities, including Waterbury, where we're sitting right now. And our job is to bring high-speed internet to those communities, period. But we are a public entity. We're run very much like a select board. So open meetings, public records, all the transparency that you would expect from your town government.
How many CUDs are there in the state right now?
So right now there are nine. There was the very first one was EC Fiber, just to our south. We were created in 2018 after some votes in the on town meeting day. The remaining seven were all created last year, sort of in the wave of realizing how important internet access was in the face of the pandemic.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Why is this a better approach to getting high-speed internet into rural areas of Vermont than others we've attempted?
So we are 100% committed. So from the beginning, we are 100% committed to getting 100% of people service. And we're not talking about just good enough service. We're going to leapfrog all of those other technologies and go right for the jugular, right for the best option that's out there, and that's fiber to the premises, to every person. The reason that this hasn't happened in the past is because commercial interests have to turn a profit.
Right.
We are not a commercial interest. We do not have to turn a profit, just like your fire department doesn't turn a profit. We're trying to take the kind of the frustration and the anger from the community, convert that into this sort of public push. And because we're a public entity, we can actually get things like revenue bonds. So a town might bond for department example.
Good.
They might bond for a fire station, and that gets paid off over time. So revenue bonds, because we're a municipality, we have the option to do that as well. Reasonably cheap borrowing and no profit. We can say, no, we're going to go out to the end of that road and not have to explain to shareholders why.
Mm-hmm. All right. So you've got 21 different communities involved in CV Fiber, and I don't expect you to list them all, but give us kind of the parameters of what Central Vermont means to CV Fiber.
Sure. So it's kind of grown organically over time. So I probably could list them, but it's mostly Washington County. The newest entrant is Waterbury, but we also have, you know, Duxbury up into Elmore, down into Roxbury, east to Washington, and up to our northeastern corner is Cabot.
Mm.
So basically all of those towns and cities within those kind of four corners are members.
when you started this idea, did you have a minimum where you knew I need six communities to make this work, six contiguous communities, or, you know, if we get 10, this will really be, doable? What was the number you had in mind, and now you have 21? So, you know, is that still short of what you thought you might get, or?
So, I mean, again, because this is a community effort and we're interested in, hearing from towns, and over time, like I said, it's grown organically as towns have decided that they actually do want to join. The votes for town meeting happened in about a dozen towns. So I started, by talking to a whole bunch of select boards, city councils, and those dozen towns all voted in some cases unanimously to join. I didn't really have a top end idea of when we would stop kind of taking in towns, but I thought 20 just as a nice round number. I thought that might be the right place to stop, but I mean, ultimately it's up to the board. There are, at any given time, 21 voting members on the board. And if they think that my ideas are bad, they're going to tell me and we'll have a vote.
Wow. All right. So tell us about the $2.8 million grant that CB Fiber has just received.
Sure. So this is essentially speeding up in a really concrete way our construction plans for next year. There was a lot of federal funding that came to Vermont in light of the COVID response. So the legislature – federal funds approved by U.S. Congress came to the state. The state legislature decided that a large portion of this was going to go to funding broadband deployment. And so that money sort of got split up between the CUDs to, push these community efforts forward. Mm-hmm. And that $2.8 million is for us essentially to finish doing what's called a pole inventory, to get very good GPS data and information about every single utility pole in the district. Once we have that for the 21 towns, we can then get a really good sense of where the fiber has to go. And that $2.8 million also pays for some of the early engineering, something called a high-level design. So we have a basic idea of, now that we have these 21 towns, we know where all the poles are, which poles are we going to use? And where are we going to actually string the fiber to make sure that everybody, including, again, person at the end of the road, gets service? And we're looking to get about 95% coverage of anybody unserved and underserved at the end of 3 years. So this is essentially, gets us almost, just up to the point of construction.
So those utility poles are existing infrastructure that you can use to string out fiber to all parts of the 21 communities?
That's right. That's right. So, yeah, those utility poles are, by state law, are available for infrastructure like this. We have to essentially pay a rental for each pole that we use, but it's kind of built into our overall costs.
I'm going to back up to something you said earlier, because as I understand it, commercial entities haven't built out the network in rural states like Vermont and rural communities because it gets very cost prohibitive to reach the most rural areas. So that responsibility now gets shifted to the CUD like CV Fiber. Am I correct about that?
Yep, that's right.
And so
we have, we can't take tax money from towns. It's written into the statute that, if Waterbury, for example, decided that they really wanted to give us a kickstart and write us a big check or something, they can't. So, and that firewall was put into place after the Burlington Telecom fiasco, where the city was essentially kind of moving funds from one place to the other.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have that opportunity to kind of break in that way. So we did a feasibility study before any of this bigger funding came down the pike, and we were going to be building this anyways. It was just going to be quite a bit slower. The density that we were looking for is across the entire network as we were building it, we had to hit 6 subscribers per mile. The commercial providers were looking at something more like 12, 15, 20, just depending on the cost of their infrastructure. So as long as we could hit 6 people signing up, and by the surveys that we took, we were pretty confident that that was going to happen. People are really, really hungry for this, even pre-COVID. So yeah, we were we're pretty sure that we're going to hit those numbers and probably go quite a bit beyond.
And the other thing that is, I believe, part of your mission is to keep it affordable. So you're going to the last house on the road, the most expensive one to reach, and you want to make that an affordable proposition. So again, you know, how is that accomplished by CV Fiber?
That is a great question, and there are a couple of factors that allow us to do this. So there are federal programs, so like right now, if folks are having a hard time paying for their internet service, the FCC, I don't remember the link off the top of my head, but the FCC has a program to supplement costs of internet service for folks who can't afford it to the tune of $30 or $40 a month, I think. So in addition to things like that, when we get this federal money, you know, we're not putting it into our pockets. This is going to be reducing the cost for everybody across the board. That's money that we don't have to borrow. So when you look at EC Fiber, who built, you know, they built their entire network with borrowed money, even this cheaper borrowed money. But if you break down the cost of what the monthly rate, their basic monthly rate of $74 a month, about half of that is going to debt service. Mm. So, working out the math, you know, half of 78 gets you about 40. And so their actual, you know, paying off the cost of their actual infrastructure, it's more like $40. I'm not saying that we're going to be offering $40. I mean, smarter folks than me are going to have to sit down and sort of work out the math and see what that formula is. But we are planning, and we are actually required to, as nature, you know, by the grants that we're getting, that we have to think about this. We have to have a plan for folks that can't afford whatever that base rate is, mm-hmm. that we eventually set.
But eventually, a home that never could have had high-speed internet and the top-of-the-line high-speed internet today will be able to get it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jeremy, how great is the need for high-speed internet in the 21 communities that CV Fiber is serving?
So by the numbers that the state has, we have – so CV Fiber is kind of a decent mirror of the state overall. So we've got some dense areas, we've got Montpelier, Barrie, and we've got some outlying areas that have, you know, almost no service. So about 20% of addresses, that's not people necessarily, but addresses that we can identify, don't have what we would consider, or what the FCC would consider to be, you know, reasonably good service. I have a lot of anecdotes. I have a lot of people who have called or talked to me in various capacities saying, this is something that we need, or, hey, we're moving to this house on Road X in this town. Does it have service? When are you going to be there? And when I ask them, or when I have to tell them, like, well, we'll be there. We're not there now. And they're saying, well, okay. And then they may not get back to us. So the need is there. I mean, it's not there everywhere, but the places that we're starting we are targeting only those places that are underserved. We are not building in the places that are denser. So this is like the opposite of what a commercial entity would do. We're going to those, you know, sparser places, the more remote places first, because the logic here is that those are the folks that A, need it the most. And again, we're trying to provide this public service, but these are also the folks that are most likely to take the service.
Right.
So if we build it, it's not like everybody just is forced to do this. You still have a kind of a competitive choice. You can stay with the existing providers. That's fine. But we'll be there. We'll be available. And we're sort of expecting, again, based on our surveys in the past, we kind of know what percentage we're expecting to get of folks to sign up.
So where is CV Fiber right now in the development? You probably aren't in a house yet, but what's next? And then when will people start hooking up to CV Fiber?
So I'm optimistic that we can have the first folks connected Q2 or Q3 next year. It just depends on some other timing is kind of out of our control. Mm-hmm. But the towns where we're starting first, and where we actually have folks out in the field today doing that poll inventory, I don't remember which towns they're in right now. In any event, we're going to start building in Moortown, Middlesex, Worcester, Calais, East Montpelier. And essentially, most of the folks, if you're listening and you're in one of those towns, most of the folks, if you only have a DSL connection, if you don't have cable, if you don't have some other alternative, we will probably be building to your house sometime next year.
Well, you're making one person very happy. We've got Barry calling from East Callis, one of the towns you just mentioned. Hi, Barry. Go right ahead. What do you got for Jeremy today?
Hi, Jeremy. It's Barry Burns, the former president of Washington Electric Co-op. I called in late, so I don't know if you addressed our relationship with CB Fiber in WEC borrowing money and building out the backbone infrastructure.
So
did you mention that?
Yeah. No, thanks for that, Barry. I'm really glad that you called. I was literally during the break just talking to Rick about really need to mention Washington Electric Co-op. So do you want to briefly tell the folks about what's happening with WEC and our partnership?
Sure. We've been working with CB Fiber for the last couple of years in the planning stage, and Washington Electric Co-op, which serves about 12,000 homes in 41 towns, is going to be working with CB Fiber. We're going to be building out what they call dark fiber, the fiber on all of our poles and CB's town in our towns, and leasing it to CB Fiber at cost, and then they're going to be responsible for taking the fiber from connecting to our poles to that fiber and giving all of our members service. So it's going to, by our involvement, we're going to be able to bring long-term, low-cost federal money to the project, and it's going to help our members get service sooner. So we really are glad to be working together on this. And Jeremy, thank you for your long-term help in pushing this through all of these towns and through the state.
Well, Barry, thanks for that call. That's fantastic. If I remember correctly, and Christine Hallquist is now the director of the Community Broadband Board, but when she ran for governor, she had talked about how you could utilize this existing infrastructure with the utilities. She had been with
Vermont Electric Co-op.
Okay, and so is this kind of the concept that Barry's just talking about, that you know, we're taking that now and finding these partnerships and getting it to the last mile, that last home?
Yeah, because, I mean, in a very real way, you know, the motivation for creating, you know, electric co-ops back 100 years ago is very similar to the motivation behind creating, we're not a co-op per se, but to create this public entity, this nonprofit entity that's going to provide this public service. But, yeah, we've been talking to folks at WEC, and I've been having conversations with Barry and his board and his employees since the beginning, since before CV Fiber was even created. So, yes, I mean, the stuff that Christine was talking about, that was stuff that we were doing. And it's we're really, really optimistic that taking their understanding of their electric network and what we're hoping to do building fiber and building, you know, internet service is really going to – we're really – they're really helping us. We're really helping them. It is such a win-win.
Yeah, symbiotic.
Yeah.
All right. Because of the pandemic, and you touched on this very early, what have we learned about the importance of having high-speed internet at least available for every household and business in the state?
So, I mean, this is really the thing that's sometimes called the digital divide, right? So there are things that you just can't do if you don't have access to reasonably fast internet service. You know, and so there was a press conference announcing that, you know, these grants on Monday, and this was one of the things that, you know, that we talked about, you know, telemedicine and education. And I told the assembled group that, you know, when I'm at home and when my kids were forced to be at home, you know, if they had to have a Zoom meeting, you know, everybody would ask, you know, are you downloading anything? Because the screen would get blocky and it would, you know, things would cut out. And so everybody essentially had to like be very aware of what was happening. And that's really when you're expected to use the internet to apply for jobs, to talk with your therapist or your doctor, or to do anything to engage in kind of the 21st century economy, it's not tenable to try to struggle with a bad connection. And just to give you some context about the speed of fiber when we have this installed, you know, when I was pitching this to Worcester, we're looking at the number of actual houses in Worcester, and I think we had figured it out that with one fiber connection, everybody in Worcester, every house in Worcester could be watching Netflix at the same time on one fiber.
Wow.
So, but we're talking about building one of those fibers to each house. So there's not really that same capacity issue. This is the future-proof solution to getting everybody access, and real access, and access that's likely to be sufficient and easily upgradable for the next 30 years.
And is CV Fiber offering just high-speed internet? Does it include phone, cable, or what exactly are the services you'd be offering?
That's a great question. So that's kind of the pricing packages, and exactly what we're offering hasn't been worked out yet. As we're meeting with potential operators and contractors that are going to be helping us to build and essentially offer the service, we'll very likely have like a bundled phone offering that's going to be separate from the internet service. We're not likely to offer cable in the way that you'd think about it, but we'll certainly, you know, connect folks to streaming services. Mm-hmm. You know, if you buy a Roku box or something like that that you can plug into your TV, I mean, that's extremely popular and super easy to do as long as you have a fast enough connection.
Yeah, I have found after years of thinking it was some great mystery, I've set it up with a Fire Stick and off you go, and it's actually quite simple. Probably the way of how we're going to watch television and streaming for the rest of our lives. We've got about a minute left. Will you be able to share expenses, equipment with other CUDs in the state, or are these all going to be individual entities?
So we do this to a certain extent already. I mean, in terms of organizing, we've actually, I think last year, we all came together, all the CUDs came together and created something called the Vermont Communications Union District Association. We have an employee, and he, you know, helps us kind of keep everything moving forward. If one CUD is doing something, and you know, so I'm thinking like Waterbury, for example. Waterbury, where we are on Monday, actually voted to also join Lamoille FiberNet, so they're going to be members of both CUDs at the same time. And we're always in constant conversations with the other CUDs, because there's going to be parts of Waterbury that it's going to make way more sense to come in from Stowe.
Gotcha.
Rather than coming in from, you know, Duxbury or some other direction.
Very good. Jeremy Hansen is the chair of CV Fiber. You can learn more about them at cvfiber.net. Jeremy, great to hear about the plans for this CUD. Best of luck.
Thanks, Rick.
All right, CBS News is next, and then we're going to learn about what's happening at an old ski resort in Reedsboro. And coming up today at 1 o'clock, it's the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. That's followed by The Getaway with Greg Hooker. And tomorrow morning on the Morning News Service, it's the official debut of our new news anchor, Kaya Neely. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table, and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest, and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingari. There's a wonderful website for you to explore when you have a few hours and you want to reminisce about ski resorts of the past. It's called the New England Lost Ski Areas Project, and the website is NELSAP or NELSAP.org. The ski areas of the past are broken down by state and by region within the state. In the southern Vermont section, you'll find one down in Hartwellville called Dutch Hill. But here's a twist. Dutch Hill has been found again, and that's what we're going to talk about next. A chapter of the Catamount Trail Association called DASH has been hard at work breathing new life into Dutch Hill. And while it won't be the resort that Dutch Hill once was, it's going to make a lot of skiers and hikers and, yes, even sledders mighty happy. Joining me now is the president of the Dutch Hill Alliance and of Skiers and Hikers, or DASH, Bill Beatty. Bill, thanks so much for being on the show this morning.
Good morning, Rick, and thank you for having me on.
Good morning. It's our pleasure. Listeners, to ask our guests about the efforts of DASH or to share your memories of Dutch Hill, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Bill, give us a little history of the Dutch Hill Ski Resort.
Okay, Rick, well, Dutch Hill was not one of the first areas in Vermont, but it was pretty close. It started, the concept sprung out of the North Adams, Massachusetts Ski Club. They had an early area that they used on the foot of Mount Greylock near the North Adams access road up to the Mount Greylock range. But they needed an area with more natural snow, and they became aware of some property in Hartwellville that was for sale. It was probably around 1942 that the purchase was made, and work began on the area in 1943, and I believe it opened somewhere early in 1944, in January of 1944. With rope tow service. So that was the beginning of Dutch Hill. I think they put a T-bar in 1946, one of the first T-bars in the state of Vermont to go in. They had a vertical drop of about 525 feet. There was, you know, novice area, but there was also some very steep pitches that gave them two well-known expert trails, the Christiana and the Windmill. So they became fairly well-known as a mom-and-pop type ski area, but there were also ski buses coming from New York City in those days, in the 40s and the 50s. So it was a booming area post-World War II.
So it lasted from about 1944 through about 85, I believe. What led to the demise of Dutch Hill?
Well, I think the demise of Dutch Hill and a lot of the smaller mom-and-pop style ski areas that were prevalent in the 40s and 50s, snowmaking was an issue, of course. It didn't have snowmaking capability. It didn't have a chairlift. It didn't have a lot of the amenities that the bigger areas such as Mount Snow and Stratton were coming on the scene in those days. And so those areas became more of a destination for the out-of-town skiers. And Dutch Hill hung on there for, through the 70s and into the 80s, serving more of the local population. But they had lost their destination skiers from the bigger urban areas.
So from 85 until just recently, was the hill, the ski areas, the runs cared for at all?
No, since 85, there's been regenerative growth coming in. A lot of birch and young growth. Filling in the former trails, and that's what we are contending with today. Because obviously, to do any kind of backcountry skiing, you've got to have some amount of glading done. So that's the kind of work that we're doing at Dutch Hill, glading, thinning out. With the guidance of the U.S. Forest Service, going by their standards. We don't cut anything over 5 inches in diameter at breast height. So we make selections on what to save, what to take out, based on the advice we get from the Forest Service.
So how did DASH, the Dutch Hill Alliance of Skiers and Hikers, get started and, you know, get involved to make Dutch Hill skiable again?
Well, it was, you'd have to go back to October of 2014. The Forest Service had issued a call. You know, they were doing a study on the south of Route 9 area, and they were, you know, within the study, it was going to have wildlife management, recreational activity, and also forestry work. So at that time, in November of 14, Jeff Nugent, who's a member of our executive committee today and is always out on the Hill working, had the idea, he had the inspiration to, and made the written suggestion to the Forest Service that some consideration be given to Dutch Hill for backcountry skiing purposes. So that was the very beginning of it. It sprung from Jeff's idea, and he reached out to Stan Bartlett, who's a CTA member. He is the crew chief for the first two sections of the Catamount Trail Association. Sam's also an avid backcountry skier and a current member of our executive committee at DASH. And together they brought in Diana Todd, who has been involved with the Hogback Mountain project on Route 9 mm-hmm. in Marlborough, Vermont.
Right.
And you know, they started reaching out and batting ideas around, and somewhere around I had kind of gotten wind of it because the word was out that, you know, rumor wise that there was some interest in Dutch Hill. So I reached out to the Hogback group, and Diana Todd responded to me, and a couple weeks later my wife Marty and myself and Diana took a hike up Dutch Hill, and we, we discussed the possibilities, and it looked like we could see an opening where we could attract and bring in other people with other expertise to help create a Vermont nonprofit organization.
Bill, did you ski at Dutch Hill back in the day?
I did. I started skiing at Dutch Hill when I was about 6 years old.
Wow.
I had skied a few years previous to that in other locations, but in backyards and small hills and hiking up and down, that kind of thing. But I started skiing at Dutch Hill at about 6 years old.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And, so I skied there through my high school years. Post high school, 1 year, I worked there as a race coach also, as you know, just whatever they needed me to do during the week, that kind of thing. So, from there, I moved on to Jiminy Peak in Massachusetts, and then up to what was Glen Ellen at the time, and then Mad River area. I lived up there and worked up there for a few years in the 70s. So, yeah, I've been around Vermont skiing for quite a while.
Well, Bill, as we approach winter, what will people find at Dutch Hill? You know, what will the facilities be like, the ski area be like when they head out to Dutch Hill this winter?
Okay, so at Dutch Hill, we have, like I mentioned previously, we have a 525-foot vertical drop. So it's not a huge mountain, but our parking lot sits at 1,920 feet or something like that. So.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have the same elevation as the base of Mount Snow, for instance. And so we're in a decent snow belt for natural snow. So recently, within the past couple of years, I've skied there on May 1st. So it holds snow. If it's a good snow year, obviously we need natural snow. There's no snowmaking or anything like that. There are no facilities other than an incredible parking lot that holds plenty of cars, easy access to the mountain. You just park your vehicle and you're on the up track and you're going up. And so it's kind of lap skiing. Everybody does, you know, four or five laps if you're, you know, in good shape, fewer if you're like me at 73 years old, two's plenty. But, yeah, so there's a terrain that varies from very novice terrain, to some expert and steeper skiing. We just completed rehabilitating the Christiana Trail, which was one of those expert trails that I mentioned earlier. And we're very pleased with how it came out. It's going to be a thrill to ski it again after 30-plus years of being grown in and not being able to ski it. It was a difficult trail back in the day because it has a short, probably 30, 40-yard pitch that's approaching 40 degrees. But it's more complicated now because not only is it still 40 degrees, but it's also gladed. So it will be interesting. I'm hoping everyone uses caution when they start to ski it and get comfortable with the pitch and the glading.
Dutch,
we're looking forward to having that open.
Bill, this is not a ski area with all the amenities. So who will enjoy this kind of experience when they come out to Dutch Hill this winter?
Well, we certainly see snowshoers, cross-country skiers, backcountry skiers and splitboard people coming out, children sliding down on the lower novice slope, which is very close to the road. So families often come who are not even skiers and hike up on the meadows and slide down in toboggans and whatnot. So it's kind of it's open to anyone to come and enjoy for the winter. You just need to be prepared to come with your lunch, warm clothing, and your car is your base lodge.
Which a lot of people got used to last year during the pandemic.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, it's not necessarily a bad thing, to be honest.
Nope.
It's a nice break. We get a lot of people who ski at the big commercial resorts, and they just want to take a day off and be quiet and get into the woods. That happens as well. Somebody does, if you think about it, if you're waiting in line at Stratton or Mount Snow for 40 minutes to get on a lift, you can be at the top of Dutch Hill in that 40 minutes, and you've gotten plenty of exercise. So
Wow. We
get every type of skier and hiker, snowboarder, and even non-skiers, as I mentioned, just coming to the base of the mountain and having fun in the snow.
You've had several fall work days and have one coming up this Saturday, I believe. So what kind of work needs to be done there?
Well, we just completed, as I mentioned, the Christiana, and that was a huge effort this year to get that trail done. It's from top to bottom. That's been gladed. We're working on another glade now, which we're simply expanding. We have permission to further expand that glade. So that project may be not totally completed this year. It may go on next year. That expansion just kind of happens year in and year out. We do a little bit more on that area. There are some small areas where there's some handwork with hand tools to be done, and for the average volunteer to come, that's the kind of work that they could expect to do. Chainsaw people have to be certified with the Forest Service, and we have a chainsaw team that does all of that work. So that's the kind of work we're doing. We're thinning out, opening up areas that really would be too tight to ski because of the growth.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in a thinning process.
Let's take a call from our friend over in East Corinth, Wade. Hey, Wade, how you doing?
Good. I'm glad I got this show.
Yeah, isn't it interesting?
Sounds great. Want to offer congratulations, moral support, and hopefully not condolences for opening another volunteer ski area. It's a lot of work, and you got your work cut out for you, but it's very rewarding, and it's gonna be nothing but an asset to that area for sure. So congratulations to your guest and getting this up and going.
Yep. And Bill, you should know that Wade is from Northeast Slopes over in East Corinth. So, okay. Yeah.
Great.
Well, yet another voluntary area that's, and we've had our couple weed whacking clearing sessions. I'm going over to climb some towers and do a little maintenance this morning, get started on my regular Wednesday regimen. And this is a little bit of an unrelated but segue to just bring something up that has happened over the last couple of weeks. And I read another article yesterday that another big ski area has yet delved out another slap in the face to our local ski enthusiast, is that they're offering a fast pass, which is a $49 extra charge on top of a $160 or $80 day pass to bypass the lift line and jump on in front of everybody else.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah.
But we will not be offering that on either our T-Bar or Rope Toes.
All right. Thanks for that, Wade.
So maybe those disgruntled guests and people are going to cancel their season passes at that big place. Maybe we'll be doing some skinning and hiking up down at Dutch Hill.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
And they're entirely welcome.
Are there specific rules to using the area, Bill?
Well, we certainly would appreciate everyone packing in and packing out,
yep.
Leaving no trace, obviously. We have worked closely with the Forest Service to, you know, have the proper environmental approach to what we're doing. And so we're constantly in the process of finding things and picking things up, some things that have been there for years. It's kind of fun every once in a while. We'll find a ski basket from the 1950s or a broken pole or something like that. The more recent stuff sometimes, is a bit annoying to find bottles and cans on the slopes and areas. So please, by all means, use the property but respect it and take out what you brought in. That's all we ask. The other thing that is, please don't foot pack or walk in boots up the skin track, because that creates post holes, and we'd rather keep the snowshoers and those who want to attempt to walk up without anything on their feet on the edges of the trails, but not on the skin track.
Bingo. And we have about 30 seconds left, Bill, but how can people support the effort of Dash and getting Dutch Hill running again?
Well, we can certainly check out dashforvermont.org, our website. We have a Facebook page, Dutch Hill Alliance of Skiers and Hikers, there'll be a lot more information on there. Tom Boudreau is our secretary, and he's a historian as well. So he's got a more detailed history of Dutch Hill and what's been happening with Dash posted on the website. So for anyone interested in further information, that's where to go.
All right. Bill Beatty is the president of the Dutch Hill Alliance of Skiers and Hikers. The website is DHASH, the number 4VT. That's -4VT.org. Bill, thanks for sharing the history and the future of Dutch Hill with us this morning.
Thank you very much for having me, Rick. And hopefully we'll see everyone out on the hill.
Absolutely. All right. Top of the hour news is next, and then we're going to hear from a couple of adoption experts. And coming up today, 5:30 to 7, afternoon news service, followed by the Brady Farkas Show, and then Dinner Jazz with John Wilson. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. There are currently 110 Vermont children and youth in foster care waiting for families to adopt them. if you've ever considered adopting a child. I hope you'll spend the next half hour listening to my two guests as we discuss who these children are and the logistics of adoption. Joining me is Gilly Hopkins, the Permanency Planning Program Manager for the Department for Children and Families, Family Services Division. Gilly, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick.
You're welcome. And also, we have Wanda Audette, the Director of Adoption at the Lund Family Center. Wanda, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you, Rick.
You're welcome.
My pleasure.
Good. Listeners, to ask our guests about adoption, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Gilly, I mentioned there are 110 children and youths in Vermont in foster care looking for adopting families. That number gives us a sense of the situation, but I'd like to individualize this discussion as much as I can without naming names, of course. Can you give me an example of circumstances of how these girls and boys, young women and men, wind up in foster care?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, as you referenced, of course, all involvement with DCF is confidential, but generally speaking, young people will have experienced an event or a series of events, typically, of abuse and neglect in their early life, which leads the department to become involved. We remove those children. Our primary goal is almost always reunification. It's very rare for us not to engage in efforts with parents to try and get kids back home. But unfortunately, sometimes we find that we're not able to return children to their home, and we wind up filing with the court for termination of parental rights, and children find themselves, after typically a pretty long process, I think it averages right now at about 30 months after they were removed from their family, they wind up being freed for adoption. So time has passed for them, and they're often a little bit older. They are kids in your community. They're kids in your children's schools and on their sports teams. They work in local businesses, and they do have challenges. Many of them, because of the abuse and neglect that they've experienced, require services and sort of very attuned and engaged parenting.
And once that is determined, that they will not return to their families, that they are now eligible for adoption, you know, how long before they are adopted and placed with a family?
So we hope that, and the vast majority of children actually at the time that a termination of parental rights is granted, the vast majority of children are placed in with a family who will adopt them. Mm-hmm. That 100 to 110 children that we're talking about are the children who are either placed, you know, their needs are higher and they're placed in a facility or with a family to meet their needs, but that the plan isn't for them to adopt. So those children will often wait a couple of years as we search for a family for them.
Wanda, you've met these kids. You've gotten to know them. What can you tell us about them?
Well, it's actually my staff that I have four recruiters that are throughout the state of Vermont who have those children that are waiting on their caseload that they meet with at least monthly. And like Gilly said, they're the kids that are in our community, that are in our, you know, in our schools, on our sports teams, that are playing with, you know, had played with my kids when my kids were doing that. They're children. They may have, you know, some challenges based on the experiences that they had, their early childhood experiences that they experienced based on being removed from their birth parents, maybe abuse and neglect that they have suffered has caused some, you know, some trauma, but they're playing sports, they love arts and crafts, and they want to belong to a family and have an unconditional relationship.
And what are the ages, Wanda, of these children in foster care right now who could be adopted?
The children that we have currently on our caseload are between the ages of 7 and 17¾. we actually work with kids, even if kids that have not found permanency when they turn 18, we are still working with those youth, because we believe that being a member of a family is a right, it's not a privilege, and that if youth are wanting to work with us towards that end, we will continue to work with them, and we'll do an adult adoption.
Wow.
And, you know, we support that, and the state supports that. We don't just drop off kids.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to ask you both this, and it's not to demean the foster families and parents, because fostering is incredible. But what changes, Gilly, do you see in a child when they've been adopted rather than, you know, being with a foster family?
Well, statistically speaking, we can speak sort of in generalities that the research actually really supports. So a young person in foster care or a young person who turns 18 having not been adopted is extraordinarily at risk for incarceration, for physical health impacts, for mental health diagnoses, homelessness, lack of high school completion, as well as sort of premature pregnancy. So those risks are all much, much higher for kids who are in foster care or who turn 18 without having a permanent family than for children who are adopted. Those things all reduce. And then practically speaking, I mean, when you think about it, you think about just things like, you know, you're applying for your first car loan. And there's no one who can co-sign with you if you don't have parents, whereas if you're adopted, you do. You're trying to get yourself into higher education, and you need help navigating the college application process and the financial aid process. That's something – that's the role of a parent as a young adult. You know, parenting doesn't end at 18. And frankly speaking, I think the department, while we do our best – when a child in the custody of the department, we're not good parents. You know, our workers aren't the folks who a young person can call at 11 o'clock at night when they're, you know, 19, 20 and need help with, you know, the end of their first major relationship. That's not a social worker that you call. Yeah. That's your parent.
Yeah. Wanda, I'm asking the same question. You know, what do your caseworkers see, you know, really on a personal level, too, of the changes in a child when they have been adopted?
Well, I often use when I speak to people, I think about, you know, when you're seeing that middle school student in the classroom and they maybe are in foster care, and our foster parents do an incredible job holding that child, keeping that child safe, and providing for them in a temporary situation. But there's always that sort of worry in the back of that child's mind, the worry of, will I have to move?
Right.
Will something happen and come up? And, you know, so while they're in that middle school classroom and they're supposed to be taking in that education that they're supposed to be given, but when they have that weighing on their mind of, you know, I don't have what Susie has next to me. And so that's a worry. It makes it hard and makes it not be, have them have that security of being able to be fully present, you know, in the things that they're participating in, because they have that worry. And we forget about that so often because we say things like, kids are so resilient. And I recently had an 18-year-old who we did an adult adoption for, who said to me, I'm sick and tired of people telling me I'm so resilient, because at 18, I shouldn't have to be resilient.
Right.
And those are things that really stuck with me. And you know, so I agree with everything. I can't really add any more to that because I think Gilly really said, you know, all of the really good key points.
All right. Gilly Hopkins, what types of homes, families, situations do you look for to be able to approve a couple or an individual to allow them to adopt?
We really, for all of our waiting children, we use their voice as the primary driver in seeking a home. We work with youth with the approval of their guardian ad litem, social worker, and attorney to develop their very own recruitment plans, and they identify what it is that they're looking for in a family. So our need for families is as diverse as the children of Vermont. Some young people are really clear that they are wanting a sort of a traditional heteronormative two-parent household. Other young people are would prefer, often based on the traumatic experiences they've experienced, a single parent of a particular gender or life experience. They specify the environment they're looking for. We are looking for families who live rurally. A lot of young people in Vermont, we find, specifically want to live in a rural environment with farm animals if possible. Mm. We are looking for parents in more urban environments. Sometimes there are occasions when we wind up placing youth out of state, either because of their particular needs or their desire for a family. So we work with them. We have a pretty in-depth process to match a child with a family, but we're looking for all families, single people, couples, young people, older, experienced parents, folks who've never parented before. We really are open to everything.
Well, Wanda, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line. One of our listeners wanted to know, what is the right age to adopt? And I know that probably depends on the person and the individual, but, you know, is there, you know, a time that people really seem to have security and have the ability, maybe, you know, both mentally, emotionally, economically, to support having a child come into their lives through adoption?
Right. That's a really good question. So the other side of the question that you had asked about, the youth being prepared. Mm-hmm. So families that are interested in adopting, they either need to be licensed Vermont foster parents or out of state, licensed foster parents, or they have to go through a home study evaluation process where we do a lot of vetting of those families to be able to look at who they are, their finances, any kind of, you know, we look at their, you know, if there's any criminal history, we do background checks, we do driving checks, we do finance checks, we do physical checks, we get references. We do all of those things so that we're vetting families the best that we can to make the best possible matches. And so we certainly see, you know, a wide variety in ages of families coming forward, usually minimum age of about 25 you know, upward to, you know, we do some kinship placements of 70-year-olds. If everybody in those age groups are able to sort of pass and go through either a licensing or a home study evaluation so that their doctor's saying they're in good, you know, physical health to be able to care for a child. And the other thing is that families are not alone after. You know, adoption is not, it's not a one and done. We really try to support families, you know, into the future. We, Lund and several other agencies provide post-permanency services to families so that we are helping them along their journey. This is about a lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, so if what we say is if you're up for a challenge and you want to learn more, people can learn more about the kids that we have available at Project Family, VermontVT.gov. We have several of our kids that are listed there that are in need of a forever family. If people want to learn about other ways that they can, you know, get involved or what the process would be about, you know, going through. And we really try to make sure that we are doing really good matches to make sure that the child would match really well with the family that's coming forward.
Mm-hmm. Gilly, how many Vermont children are adopted in the state in a normal year?
So it really ranges. COVID has changed things, but anywhere from 200 to 300. And again, most of those young people are adopted by the foster family that's providing care to them throughout their foster care journey. But we do wind up with this group of 100 or so young people who are just looking.
And Wanda, now Gilly mentioned the pandemic. How has the pandemic changed or impacted fostering in the state and adoptions?
So I'll let Gilly chat about fostering. But I can tell you that what it's done for adoption is made us sort of repivot our world of Zoom. So our recruiters are, you know, have been in some ways unable to meet with our youth face-to-face, so we're doing it via Zoom so that we're connecting in that way. But I am really proud of the state of Vermont and the FSWs, DCF, Project Family, that we've kept the work going because this is urgent. Kids need families now, and we can't have a pandemic stop our work of being able to sort of move children into their forever family. So we've pivoted with the times. So that's what I would have to say about adoption. We're still having court hearings. They're all via WebEx, and we're meeting with families and clients uniquely.
And Gilly, as far as fostering, the effects of the pandemic?
Oh man, that's a complicated question. I think one of the things that we've experienced so acutely is just a sort of a crisis in not having enough foster homes. As human beings, I think folks have been hesitant to open their homes to children at this uncertain time. And so we are in desperate need of families to take children in temporarily. We have experienced challenges with all of our sort of congregate care settings. So when there's an emergency, a child goes into crisis, they need to be placed in a group home-like setting. All of those settings have been impacted by COVID. They're faced with staffing shortages and capacity issues. And then our foster care licensing situation, for quite some time, our licensors, we have a separate team of licensors, were not providing in-person home visits. They're now back to that. But we sort of just had a little bit of a logjam for a period of time due to COVID, and we continue to just experience a reduced rate of interest and folks coming home to provide care, coming forward to provide care.
And Gilly, can you kind of walk us through the process if someone's listening who is interested in adopting, what they go through the process, the timeline for the adoption process?
Yeah, absolutely. So as Wanda mentioned, there are two tracks. You can adopt as a licensed foster parent here in Vermont, or you can become home studied. So I'll let Wanda speak to the timeline for the home study process because Lund is a licensed agency and Lund does all of our home studies for these older children who are already ready for adoption. But in foster care, what happens is if you're already connected to a child, you very well may get a call from a social worker saying that something has happened in that child's life and we're looking for a place for the child to live. And your home would be visited by what we call resource coordinators in the district office that's working with that particular child. They would come to your home. You would fill out an application, and the child, as long as you passed preliminary background checks, which are, I think generally they're not particularly restrictive. So, there is not some major criminal history in your life, and your home is appropriate. You could be licensed, you could be, we call it district approved, for the child to come and live with you. Then you would have a licensor come to your home, and you would need to complete fingerprints at a law enforcement agency so that we can obtain your federal background check. Once the licensor has come to your home, has written a home study, and we have the results of your fingerprints back, then you become licensed. The timing of that process really varies, but typically it can be done, if there aren't delays with the fingerprints, it can be done in about 2 months. That you can be a licensed foster parent. You're also required to complete training. Currently, we require in those cases where you may get a call and there's a child who's a relative or who is connected to you through your community, you have a year to complete training. Most of the training currently is being offered online.
And Wanda, you have about a minute and a half, to tell us a little bit more about the other track.
Okay. So for home studies, it can take up to 60 days because we have to do a full background check with fingerprints, and we have to have at least 3 visits with the family in their home and gather the information. So it can take up to 60 days to get an approval.
All right. That's Wanda Audette. She's the director of adoption at the Lund Family Center. We've also been speaking with Gilly Hopkins, the permanency planning program manager for the Department for Children and Families, Family Services Division. Wanda, I'd love to give the website address again where people can go to learn more.
So they can contact Project Family at 1-800-746-7000. Or they can go on the web at projectfamily.vermont.gov.
All right. Fantastic. Want to thank you both for the work you're doing and for sharing your time with us this morning. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And thanks for this opportunity.
Absolutely.
Thank you for the kids. Thanks.
Excellent. All right, we're going to take a break for CBS News, get an update, and then we'll be back to hear from you. I'm going to open up the phones, want to hear about your crazy, funny, even scary coincidences that have happened to you. I had one yesterday that I'll tell you about. And a reminder that today at 11 o'clock, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. And coming up this week, we've got some Norwich hockey Friday at 6:40, Saturday at 3:40 here on WDEV.
At The Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Phones are now open until 11, and I'd love to hear some coincidences that have happened in your life. It could happen in somebody else's life that you knew about. Our numbers are 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can always email them to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I've got several to share with you, including something that happened to me yesterday that spawned this. And I'll also tell you about a book by a Vermont author that deals with the subjects and discusses the odds of these seemingly never happening coincidences. There are odds. They're going to happen. And he figures out how you can know the odds of something so strange and bizarre that has happened to you. But for now, I'd like to hear from you. Any of your experiences, 244-1777. Got to be an 802 now, right? Yeah, 802-244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. All right, here's what happened to me yesterday. So I took my car in for an oil change, and when I went to fetch my car, there was a gray Subaru in the lot, and that's what I drive, a gray Subaru. I spotted the license plate, and so I knew it was mine. And I shuffle off to this car, and I get in, except the stuff I had on the front seat was all gone. And I thought, did they clean up my front seat? Did somebody steal something? And it was It was only, you know, maybe a minute that it's been sitting out in the lot, a couple minutes. I'm thinking, that's weird. I got out and I checked the license plate again. And I was convinced that this was my car. I walked around it, and when I looked in, there was none of my stuff in this car. Something's bizarre. So here's what happened. I'm not going to give my license plate number, but let's say my Vermont license plate is KAT123, right? KAT123. This car's was KAT124. It was the very next Vermont plate in succession. Gray Subi, but upon further inspection, it was an Outback. Mine's a Crosstrek. But what are the odds of ever even seeing the very next license plate to the one you have in succession? Wild, right? And these were both being serviced at the same time, at this garage. And I, almost hopped in and drove off with it. I think the keys were in it. I was a little flummoxed when I couldn't find my things in the car. And so, I didn't start it up and drive off. Anyway, I'd love to hear any of coincidences you've stumbled upon. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. This happened once. I was down in South Miami and staying at a hotel, waiting for my car to come from the valet, you know, parking. It was all valet parking. And right in front of me, somebody gets in a car and drives off, and the next person is saying, "Hey, wait, that was my car." You know, when you have a rental car, they all look the same. You aren't sure exactly which one's yours. And in kind of a valet situation, someone can just hop in and drive off. And that's what I saw that day. So I've got a few more, but I'd love to hear yours. Anything kooky or wonderful or funny that's happened coincidentally that you'd like to share? We're at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. All right. I think we got somebody coming in. Maybe I'll read one more. All right. Years ago, I read this wonderful Arthurian legend trilogy. It was by the writer Gillian Bradshaw. And the books were Hawk of May, Kingdom of Summer, and In Winter's Shadow. Trust me, this is going somewhere. I go into a bookstore one day. They have this table with stacks of used books. And then at the corners of the tables, they have stacks about 4 feet high of books, just stacked up, right? You can't even really see what's there. I figure, oh, wow, used books. I'll see if these Gillian Bradshaw books are in here. Maybe I'll find one. I go to one of the corner stacks. I randomly lift off probably about a dozen books of the stack, and there, the one that's facing me, is Hawk of May, the first book of the trilogy. And so, amazingly, what I was looking for just happened to be in this stack. Unfortunately, the other two in the trilogy were not there, but I have since found those books. All right. On to Graniteville we go and talk to Lee. Hey, Lee, what's going on?
Hey, Rick. I almost fell over when you were talking about getting in the wrong car. I came out of a business in Randolph and went to walk to my car and went to get in it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the identical car sitting next to it. And the license plate was one digit off. And I was, like, completely thrilled. So I went back into business and hung around and kind of kept my eye out the window until the woman who owned the other car went out. And the two of us were having had a great conversation about it. We took pictures of our cars sitting next to each other. And yeah, that was probably 3 years ago. But I just had to share that with you because I thought, well, there's two of us, Rick.
Isn't that wild? You know, yeah. I'd never heard of anything like this before, and now there's two of us where this happened. Now, of course, Vermont's a smaller state, so I guess, you know, it's going to happen here. But I would just figure that when, you know, you purchase a car and the paperwork goes into Montpelier for a license plate, you know, they're just issued in succession, right? And so you know, if I buy a car and then somebody in Newport buys a car and then and the paperwork sent in next and then the next one's down in, you know, Graniteville and the next one, you know, they would get the very next plate. But, you know, who knows if, the, you know, maybe they do it by region or, you know.
Well, the interesting thing was I no doubt transferred my tags from a previous car to this car.
Oh, wow.
And but the crazy thing was it was the identical model. It
That's
was the
wild.
Same car, the same color, the same year. And I think when I went to get in it, the sticker, well, I had the same experience where my stuff, my car is usually a mess. This car was way too neat to be mine.
Say with me, Lee.
But it just blew me away because there was a sticker on the window that was not my sticker, mm-hmm. you know. And so I got out and I looked at the license plate and it read all but one digit, and the digit was the next number up.
Yeah, wow.
And I just thought that was wild. So the woman and I had a great laugh.
Oh man, I love it. All right, Lee, that's a great coincidence.
My story.
Yeah, and. We both had similar situations. I'll tell this story. It's not a coincidence, but it's a lot of fun. So I used to work for an ad agency, and we would travel a bit, and we'd fly into, you know, a town where our client is. We'd go to, you know, get it out at the airport, get the rental car, immediately drive to a hotel and check in, and there'd be the paperwork to fill in at the hotel, and they'd ask for the make and model and license plate number of your car. And my boss would fill everything in very quickly and fill it all in completely. And I thought, this is amazing. He is the smartest person I've ever met in my entire life. So after I'd seen this a number of times, I finally said to him, how do you do that? And he said, what are you talking about? How do you know the make and model, color, and license plate number of the rental car that we picked up, you know, we just picked up at the airport? Oh, he said, I don't. I just fill in anything. As a matter of fact, this one's a Datsun 280Z. Sometimes I make it a Nash Rambler. I just fill in whatever I'm thinking. And I know they're not going to tow our car. You know, they're not going to go out and look around the parking lot to make sure that there's a Nash Rambler out there. And so, yeah, he was brilliant. Looks like we've got another caller. All right, what's your coincidence?
Hello?
Hi, go right ahead.
Hi. I need to be anonymous. You'll know at the end.
Okay.
A couple of summers ago, four sisters were out for an outing to get ice cream in Rutland. When we came out, parked beside our car was the same sedan, same color. One sister went around the back, got in the back seat. The rest of us just lost it. You know, we knew it wasn't our car. So the fella sitting behind the wheel said, my wife is inside, but you can go home with us if you want. So when she finally got out, she said, I don't want to hear it. This goes no further. So we've never given her name, but it was hilarious, and we had a great laugh about it. Great coincidence.
Well, you're a really good sister to share that story and still keep everybody's name out of it. So so she's still anonymous, and no one
All
else
right,
knows thanks. About it. Oh, I love it. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye.
All right, bye-bye. Getting in the wrong car when there's the driver could have taken off. Oh, my gosh, could have exchanged wives right there. That would have been pretty scary. Wonderful story about four sisters. Especially in Vermont, you know, there's so many of the same vehicle because we like to have them a little more rugged, a little more dependable in the winter. So, you know, maybe we choose from a smaller pool of cars and we're hopping in each other's right now. All right, here's another one from me. I was doing a morning show out in Ohio, and it was me and another guy. And these two women contacted us, and they want to meet us for a drink. Course, we say yes. And so they, you know, come up with a place to meet, date and time. And on that particular night, one of them wasn't feeling very well. So another woman comes in her place. And the woman who came in her place is named Amy Schneider. So, you know, we drink, we talk, we're having fun. And Amy invites us all back to her place and invites other people over. She tells them, you know, I've got these two DJs here. And it becomes this impromptu party. All right. At some point, I tell Amy, oh, man, I really love this apartment. And she's telling us all about it. And then she tells this story. Amy gets this apartment and she moves in. And all of a sudden, she notices there's something kooky about her mail. You know, some of the bills that she expects to get each month don't arrive. Other bills for things, for credit cards or for things that she, never bought start showing up. And man, she's just going crazy. She can't figure out what's going on. And one day she, bumps into the, this is 2-3 months in, and, she bumps into her landlord and she mentions this to him just in an offhand comment. And the landlord says, huh, I wonder if it's the fact that the woman who used to rent the apartment was also named Amy Schneider. And so, amazingly, you know, the landlord never mentioned this crazy coincidence to her until she brought it up about the problem with the mail. So the Amy Schneiders, got together. They would get together monthly and exchange mail, and, you know, sort it out on their own because, you know, when you put a forward mail, you know, notice in, they don't really, you know, differentiate between one Amy Schneider and the other. So, eventually, all the mail got worked out and Amy Schneider was getting her own. She didn't have to meet with Amy Schneider every month. All right. We go to the Duke of Newbury, and it is indeed Fred with us today. Hey, Fred.
Hi. Oh, boy. I tell you. So I'm in the line. I think it was Walmart. I turned around, and I saw this guy, and I says, well, hi. How are you doing? He said, geez, I'm doing great. How about yourself? I said, geez, I've been doing great. Haven't seen you in a long time. He said, I haven't seen you either. Come to find out, he was playing along with me. I had no idea who he was. He had no idea who I was.
So, Fred, you met your match.
Yeah, it was really, really. I mean, he played along, and I thought I actually knew this guy, but this guy was pretty clever. He said, oh, yeah, hi, how are you? Gee, we haven't seen each other for a long time. Said,
oh, yeah, man. As in forever.
Yeah, really.
Oh, I love it. Fred, the Duke of Newbury, met his match in line one day. I don't think that's ever happened. All right, Fred, thanks for that story. All right, I'm going to tell you one more thing. Let's see. Oh, I should mention that, you know, these two women, Amy Schneider and the other woman, remember Amy was the fill-in for somebody who was sick. We never did ever meet that other woman who didn't show up that night. So just a coda on that story. All right. So there is a book I mentioned at the top of this little segment. It's by Vermont author Joseph Mazur. He was a math professor at Marlborough College, and he's written several books. And one that came out a few years ago was called Fluke, The Maths and Myths of Coincidences. And if you enjoy this type of thing, it's a great book to pick up. He's collected a lot of coincidences, but then he calculates the actual odds of them happening. And he says in his book, if there's any chance that something could happen, no matter how small, it is bound to happen. And he calculates the odds and of the coincidences that people have told him about. So for Lee and I, you know, the idea of parking next to a car that has the very next license plate number in the sequence, and in her case, those being the exact same car, Joseph Mazur could actually work out the math and figure out what the odds are of that happening. And some of the ones that people have notified him about are, for instance, having the same taxi driver several years and thousands of miles apart. So you might be in a cab in 1973 in New York, and then in 1985 you hop in a cab and you get them again in Las Vegas. But another one, and this is very similar to mine, but even quirkier. I said, you know, I was thinking of this book that I wanted to find when I went into this bookstore and I looked on the used book table. In this case, in a secondhand bookshop far from home, and I'll tell you where that was, this person found their own, their very own childhood copy of Winnie the Pooh on the shelf. It had their name still written inside the front panel of the book. And they were from the U.S., I think somewhere around New York City, and they found the book in Europe, I believe in Paris. So all these years later, you know, across the ocean, they walk into a bookstore, they pull out a copy of Winnie the Pooh, and it was their own childhood copy. So these coincidences do happen. If you've got more, you can always email them, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You know they get read on the air. And if you have to remain anonymous, like our one caller today who didn't want to out her sister, who hopped in, hopped in the back seat of another car with a man sitting there in the driver's seat. Maybe she thought, hell, it's great. We've got a chauffeur now. You never know. All right, Danny, I think that's going to do it. We're going to close the spigot for today, the end of the open phones and the fun coincidences. Great hearing from you on those. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And feel free to suggest topics or guests. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. And it is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Now, Bill Sayre is up next. Tomorrow, I will be broadcasting from the Norwich University Military Writers Symposium. And we've got some interesting guests lined up for that show tomorrow. I'll meet you back here tomorrow. I'm Rick Sengary.